Good. Shall we begin? You know that we have a test coming up next Tuesday. And you got your essay questions last time. I told you also last time that I would give you a few tips on particularly what to look for in the reading and also in the lectures. So in the lectures, this is a little bit different, this segment, than the form segment. It's not so much about these lists of, 12 elements of form or, that sort of thing, but there are some terminologies that are in this segment that you should know about. So for instance, when we talk about impervious cover, you should know what impervious cover is. When I talk about altitude or azimuth as regards the sun in that lecture on climate, you should know what we're talking about there. So, we were talking about compression and tension and shear and things like that. So all of those are terminologies that are specific to physical considerations, and you should definitely bone up on them. Another thing is there are some kind of rules of thumb that we were dealing with here, the massing of a building when that's right for this climate, long faces north and south, short faces east and west, width about the same as, those rules of thumb, and there were some of those in the lecture on structures and materials, or some of those in climate. Those are good things to know. And then the other thing that was a little bit different about this segment is, whereas in the earlier segment we would maybe just spend 5 minutes on a building and move to another one, in this segment often we really, we spent a third of the lecture on one building, or we spent, a quarter of the lecture on one building. And we looked really deeply at Falling Water and at Sea Ranch and at Taliesin West in that first lecture in the segment. When we talked about construction, we looked very deeply at Amiens Cathedral and Santa Maria della Fiore and Sydney Opera House, where we looked a long time at one building. You should really know that building, know what it was we were observing in that building. So those are the tips I give you on how to study the lecture material. Remember the terminologies, look for the rules of thumb, and concentrate on those examples where we spent some time really looking at that building. Then I want to talk a little bit here about this book by Lisa Hishong. I don't expect everyone to agree with this book. In fact, if you all agreed with this book, you would not be living the way you live, because in America we don't live the way Lisa Hishong wants us to live. And so I think it's worth thinking. I mean, am I happy about her perspective? Do I think she's right? Do I think she's right, but I feel a little pang of guilt because I'm not really living that way? Do I think she's right, but she's a dreamer? God, woman, that's never going to happen. Do I think she's right? And if we just understood that, we would change our behavior. What do you think about what she says? One of the things you really need to understand is her perspective on this. What is her attitude? And I don't expect you to agree with it, but you should definitely know what's her point of view on this. What is she advocating that might be different from the way that dominant American culture deals with climate and thermal issues and energy consumption and various other things? So I think that's one big takeaway. And I also am just curious, and I'll forewarn you, the Twitter card question today is really going to be about that. What do you think about what Lisa Hishong's saying? You should have all read it by now. And, do you think she's full of shit? Do you think, she's got a good point? I'll give you some options in the Twitter card question, but I want to know what you think. And I'm not, you know, I'm not selling anything here. If you violently disagree with her, more power to you. I mean, like we said at the very beginning here, it's about values. And she's got a certain set of values she brings to that book, and she's pretty clear about what she thinks. I'm just challenging you to also, rather than just float along, I'm just, you know, whatever, that you might actually have some values and you might assert those values and think, yes, I do have a point of view on this, and I should be behaving consistent with my values and my point of view. I should be looking for opportunities to avail myself of architecture that is consistent with my values. Okay, so one thing is to look at her attitude and generally what does she believe about architecture. Another thing that you definitely should be looking at is the examples. Now, in Rasmussen, it was very easy for me to tell you, you need to study the examples because there's a photograph and you see, there's, San Carlo alla Quattro Fontana, or there's Falling Water, or, you know, and I can identify what the examples are. She doesn't have pictures. No pictures! How can you write a book about architecture and have no pictures? Well, because she's not talking about what it looks like. She's talking about what it feels like. And she's giving examples of what it feels like, just like Rasmussen was giving examples of what it looked like, but with physical considerations, sometimes it's not what it looks like. Architecture is not just image. Architecture is experience of a place. So you need to, and I think she actually does a pretty good job of vicariously putting you in that place. What is it like in that experience of a thermal environment? So you need to look at the examples she's using of places that have very particular thermal qualities. So she's, for one thing, very keen on Finnish saunas or Japanese baths. I am a complete fan of, and actually she kind of keyed me into this. The first time I read that book, I'd never been all that interested in saunas or hot places or something like that. But now, holy moly, I mean, when I was in Turkey, I did Turkish baths, you know, day in, day out. They are really cool. Turkish baths are a trip. Oddly enough, in Hungary, they are totally into spa experiences. These, you know, very, very hot saunas. The hottest sauna I ever had in my life was in Hungary and in Budapest, and you kind of go in and you think, and then your body kind of adjusts to it, and after a while, whoa, it does something to your head and your pores, and you know that heat is amazing. So Finnish saunas, Japanese baths, Hungarian saunas, Turkish baths, all of these are examples she talks about. And she uses them to make a point. So you need to look at those as examples. She also has other architectural examples like gazebos and inglenooks and various other things she talks about. So although there aren't pictures that tell you about her examples, you need to know about the examples and the points she's making with those examples. So her attitude, her point of view, the examples, another thing that you should be looking for, like with Rasmussen, is parallels to things we've talked about in class. So she talks about these ancient places like Mesa Verde. She, I think, uses Mesa Verde. We looked at Mesa Verde very briefly, but we also looked at Acoma and Hattusas and some of these places that deal in a very fundamental way with physical considerations because they were done in an era when those basic things were super powerful in architecture. So you need to look where there are parallels between what we talked about in class. And another example of that is the solar houses. She talks about these passive solar houses, and we looked in class at passive solar houses. So where there are parallels, that's another good opportunity for a quiz question. It's a little skinny book. Anybody can read that book. It doesn't take very long. I think it's really well-written, easy to read. But for some of you, it should probably make you madder than hell. That's good. For others of it, it should maybe make you think, whoa, that is such great insight. That is amazing. I believe that. And that's good too. But you need to not only read it, you need to engage with it and figure out, what do I think? Okay. Any questions on the test coming up, or anything that might in the book, or yeah?
For the buildings we went over that don't have an architect, like ancient
right.
buildings, those probably wouldn't be on slide.
Okay, so the question is, if it's a building that it didn't have an architect, like Hattusius, I mean, that doesn't have an architect, that. Where there is an entry this time that says no architect noted. So the building might be there, but you'll need to just say no architect noted. So there is an option for that on this test. Any other questions? Okay, so last time we were looking at the overview, the kind of summation of physical considerations. And I ask you, well, now let's be reflective about the segment on form and the segment on physical considerations. And in your estimation, from your values, what would you do? What percentage of emphasis in the design of a building should go to form, and what emphasis in the design of a building should go to physical considerations? And I ask you to, if you have 10 points to distribute, how many to form, how many to physical considerations? And we got really, really good responses to that. But also, this always just blows me away, absolutely all over the board. There were people just completely at every end of the spectrum and in the middle. So it just lets you know, you think maybe probably everybody agrees that whatever. No, that's not true. There's a very wide divergence of preference and perception and in the end values about architecture. So let's run through some of these. So someone says, except for monumental or iconic buildings where form is paramount, physical considerations are more beautiful because they create harmony between man and nature. So I'd say 8 points for physical considerations and 2 to form. Building harmoniously with nature is true beauty. I'm going to talk a little more about that later in the lecture today, but interesting point of view. Somebody else says, I believe that a building that is truly beautiful has form that arises from in-depth examination of all environmental considerations, physical and psychological, and is authentic and honest rather than arbitrary form of subjective interest. Physical considerations, 8. Form, 2. So maybe just a little less adamant about physical considerations. Someone says, I would give 7 to physical considerations and 3 to form. I think this is because of the clear-headedness I feel when I'm in a building that is in tune with the environment. Because it is at ease with its location, I too am at ease. Generally the same direction, but a little different. Somebody says, where is that one? But he says, I would put 7 points toward physical considerations and 3 towards form. To me, keeping in tune with and preserving our natural environment is very important if we want to continue living comfortably on this planet. I believe that form can then be derived in response to physical considerations. Okay, then there's the middle of the roaders. Somebody says, I think I would give 5 points to each. Form is important for the building to make a statement, but without physical considerations, it loses its value. Then there are those going more toward form and less to physical considerations. Someone says, 7 for form, and 3 for physical considerations. I believe form is what gives the building substance and architectural identity. Physical considerations should not go unnoticed, but they're not a key component. Similarly, someone else says, I would say form is most important, 9 out of 10. Some forms in history have made buildings characterize nations and have shaped history books. Physical considerations make buildings look weird and less spectacular. Someone else says, Form 9, physical considerations 1. Even though I probably should care more about physical considerations of a building, I think that it doesn't look nice, if it doesn't look nice or display all 12 aspects of form working together, I don't want to go in it. And finally, someone says, this is very specific, light is the most important part of architecture because it gives all other parts depth and definition. I would assign all 10 points to form and particularly light. That's pretty focused. Okay, so today we're actually taking some of those ideas you guys had in there. There were a number of you that responded to that and said, well, no, these don't really have to compete with each other, do they? Couldn't you both deal with form and deal with physical considerations? Maybe even at the same time? Maybe they could work together? Maybe they could be synergistic? You know, you do one and you do the other and it makes something else? And that's kind of what we're talking about today. So we're looking at technology as a source of beauty. In other words, if we address physical considerations with technology, is that possible that that actually makes a building more beautiful in terms of form? What's the relationship between physical considerations and form? Now, I'm leading in a direction. We've got a third of the class we look at form, a third of the class we look at physical considerations. But now that we've looked at both of them, let's start looking at how they work together. And then when we look at human factors, then we're going to have a couple of lectures where we say again, well, okay, how do all of them work together? In the end, we're looking at holistic buildings. How do all of these things work together? So now that we've got two under our belt, let's think about how they work together. And I'm going to begin this discussion by telling you about a class I taught, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now, a long time ago. And this was a Plan 2 class, and I taught in that Plan 2 class for probably, I don't know, 8 or 9 years. And it was a funny class. It met once a week on Wednesday night, and it had maybe 6 or 8 of us who were faculty members in that class. So it was co-taught, and it was called Perspectives, was the name of the class. And every year, we taught it in the spring, and every year we would choose a different topic. And it would be perspectives on nature, or perspectives on love, or perspectives on education. So it would be, and the idea of perspectives is it would be different faculty members from different disciplines who might have a very different perspective on something that's kind of universally important, but the perspective might be different from different disciplines. So there was a core group of us who did this over and over again. Michael Starbird in the math department, so he's a mathematician coming to some of these perspectives. Betty Sue Flowers, who was she was head of the LBJ Library and Museum for many years, but originally she taught literature and she's a poet. She writes poetry. She did this regularly. And myself. And then we would, whatever topic we were doing, we would gather some other people who might have interesting perspectives on that. So there was one semester where we did perspectives on beauty. Beauty. Now that's something I'm interested in, but so was everybody else interested in beauty. And so that particular semester, we had Betty Sue and Michael, poet and a mathematician, We also had a faculty member in the law school who is an expert on constitutional law. And we had a cosmologist, that's not cosmetologist, that's cosmetologist is makeup, cosmologist is like the physics of the universe. So super scientist kind of guy. And we had an economist in the group as well. And we also had a classical philosopher, Paul Woodruff, who was Dean of Undergraduate Studies for many years. He was in that group as well. So we're talking about perspectives on beauty. And so the format of the class was that each of us would take one Wednesday night, and we took two sometimes. And so you'd make a presentation of your perspective on beauty, and then the other people would be panelists, and they would freaking slice you to mincemeat. The whole point was to argue with you, to poke holes in your argument, to, you know, dig deeper maybe than your discipline looks at that particular issue. So, interestingly enough, everybody had very good presentations, and it was a fantastic semester from my point of view. I loved those sessions. But maybe, oddly enough, my very favorite one, the one that just seemed incredibly profound to me, was the constitutional law expert. And this guy, he's a smart guy. Okay, I'll give him that for sure, but I never thought a lawyer would freaking tell me something about beauty. Jeez, right? A lawyer? I mean, I come from a whole family of lawyers. My brother's a lawyer. My son's a lawyer. I mean, got all these lawyers. I never thought of them as really having this great perspective on beauty, but this guy comes in and he just blew us all away. So let me tell you what he said about beauty. He said the key to beauty in any discipline is craft. Craft is the word to really think about. By craft, something that is carefully put together. So that actually resonated with pretty much everyone. So the poet, Betty Sue, she could say, oh, absolutely, you know, a beautifully honed couplet in poetry is beautiful. Beautifully crafted, carefully made. Yes, that's what really makes a poem beautiful. And, you know, the lawyer was saying, you know, in a really beautiful legal argument is this argument that is perfectly crafted. It's just refined and over elaborated and honed to just the right level. So there was a kind of agreement, which that wasn't common in that group to agree, but people said, damn, yes, craft, that in all of our disciplines, craft seems to be a key to making beauty. And then this lawyer went on to say, well, there are kind of three elements to craft, three ways you can think of accomplishing craft. And one of those is economy. And by that, he meant that anything that was well-crafted would need to be lean and mean, the least expenditure to get the most impact. So in law, you don't want a wordy argument. You don't want a flaccid brief. You want it to be elegant, the least words to have the most impact, to say it just as concisely and as economically as possible. And other people agreed with that. It was interesting, the cosmologist said, maybe what we see as beautiful in the universe is that there is no fat there. There's nothing excessive. There's nothing that isn't just exactly what's needed. And that's beautiful. That elegance of economy is really, really important. Okay, so part of craft is economy. A second part is complexity. That at the same time as being lean and mean and economical, it shouldn't be dumb. It shouldn't be simplistic to the point that you don't see some nuances and some complexity to it. And Betty Sue, the poet, totally chimed in on that. She said, you know, That's what we appreciate in poetry, is that the poet is using all the tools in the toolbox. You know, those words, they mean something, and we're getting something from their meaning, but at the same time, their sound is carefully crafted. There's sound of those words, the way they rhyme or the way they alliterate. It's the sound of the words are important also. And then the rhythm and the syntax, it's the complexity of all those things layered on top of each other. That's what makes beautiful poetry. It's got to have complexity. And then the third thing, this lawyer said, is important in craft. You need economy, you need complexity. The third thing is potency. It has to make a difference. It has difference. It has to be potent. It has to be consequential. It can't not matter. It has to be important. And the classical philosophers chimed in and said, absolutely, that is so key to any kind of beauty, is that it makes a difference. It makes a contribution. It advances the world. And if it doesn't advance the world, it doesn't have that kind of beauty to it. So we've got an outline here for how you make beauty. It's about craft. And the way you accomplish that craft is by economy, by complexity, and by potency. Now, what that made me think is, wow, this is so completely applicable to architecture. I mean, in architecture, we constantly talk about craft. You make buildings. You craft buildings. It's in our lexicon. The word is just there, craft. Of course, that's about buildings. And I was just enamored of the fact that the poet and the lawyer and the cosmologist, they all saw craft as a thing that makes beauty. Well, of course it does. It's that making of something. Okay, so that's applicable to architecture. And then all of those other three words, the economy thing, yes, we're always looking at how do you make that the most impact with the least means. That's of course something that's true in architecture. And complexity, we had a segment in one of the lectures earlier about how complexity is an issue dealt with in architecture. And that potency, does it make a difference? Do you notice it? Is it spectacular? Is it wonderful? Of course that's an issue in architecture. So that really resonated with me in my own field. And then I begin to think, you know, all of this really does have to do with technology in a certain way. It's the making. It's the building. It's the craft that is a great source of beauty. Now, isn't that ironic that you get form beauty out of freaking physical considerations or craft? And in fact, there is a book that's written on beauty, a book by Elaine Scarry. And in this book, she's talking about the relationship between technology and beauty. And that book is called On Beauty and Being Just. And it was quite a popular book when this class was being taught, maybe 10 years ago. So in that book, she says the following. Though the vocabulary of beauty has been banished or driven underground in the humanities for the last two decades, it has been openly in play in those fields that aspire to have truth as their object. Mathematics, physics, astrophysics, chemistry, biochemistry, where every day in laboratories and seminar rooms, participants speak of problems that are beautiful, approaches that are elegant and simple. She talks about one thing that makes science beautiful is the aspiration for enduring certitude. You're seeking truth. And there's something in that, that there's a beauty when you discover that truth or that clarity. So she suggests that there's a kind of timeless sense of beauty that's tied to the truths that are inherent in science and technology. That there's something that just is beautiful to us when we see those truths being exemplified through science and technology. Now, is that a possible way to make beauty in buildings. Is technology, are physical considerations, a way that we can see the beauty of science and technology, the beauty of truths about gravity, about physics, about the sun, about the cosmos, about weather, about soils, about if all of those things, we know the science and the technology and the truths about them, if we build that into a building, isn't that something that amplifies this notion of certitude? There's a truth there, and that's beautiful to us. Okay, so take that as the philosophical background. And I want us to look today at really just, we don't do this very often, but we're just going to look at one architect. A lot of buildings by one architect. And that architect is a guy named Santiago Calatrava. And let me tell you a little story about Santiago Calatrava. So Calatrava was born in 1951 in Valencia, Spain. And he was born to a very prominent and wealthy Spanish family. But this was in the period of Francisco Franco, who was the dictator of Spain at the time. And under Franco, he was a socialist. So it didn't matter if your family had a lot of money or not, you were kind of shit out of luck because it was socialist period. So they had taken over a lot of the industries and a lot of people's land and so on. And so Calatrava's family didn't fare so well under Franco. And so he's a little kid in a period where his family's kind of oppressed. Now, even when he's a little bitty kid, he's interested in studying art. And so he goes to an art school in elementary school. They do that in Europe. We don't do that so much. But if a kid looks promising in science or in art or whatever, you ship him off to an elementary school that teaches him that. So he went to a kind of arts elementary school. And then when he was 13 years old, the Franco government opened up a little tiny window for people to be able to go out of the country. Prior to that, it was very difficult to get a visa to go anywhere, because it was a dictator and a socialist government. But they opened up a little window, and Calatrava's family jumped through that window, and they sent him at age 13 to study in Paris at a very well-known art school in Paris. So he goes through high school, again, studying arts. And then he's going to go to the École des Beaux-Arts, which has a great architecture program, but he was really going to go through the painting program there. And that was all set. He was ready to do it. And then in 1968, when he started to go to college, that was a difficult time politically in Paris. There were the Paris riots. They shut down the universities. And so they really didn't have classes to go to. So he actually went back to Spain, to Valencia, and returned to his parents' home. And then he thought, well, I'll just go to university here. It's maybe not as cool or as great as that one in Paris, but I'll go to what's here. He thought the art school there was not very good, but the architecture school was pretty good. So he said, okay, well, I'll go to architecture school. So he's interested in art, but he's going to go to architecture school, and he does that and gets his undergraduate degree in architecture in Valencia. But the interesting thing is he maintains his interest in art, but now he gets interested in technology, and architecture introduces him to physics and construction and structures, and he gets really very interested in that. And he decides that he wants to get a degree in civil engineering, so he does that. And then he decides he wants to do graduate work in engineering, and so he goes to Switzerland, to the ETH, which is the Technische Hochschule in Switzerland. It's German system of, it's like the MIT of Switzerland. It's a very, very technical science and engineering university. It's the best in Europe. It's fantastic. And so he goes there and he gets a dual PhD, two PhDs, one in physical sciences and one in engineering. So this guy has freaking gone to school forever. He's like 30 years old when he finally gets out of these PhD programs. But he studied art, he studied architecture, and he studied physics, and he studied engineering. And so he is the perfect bridge between form and physical considerations. He's equally interested in both of these. And all of that becomes extremely evident in the work of Santiago Calatrava. So I think this guy is in the tradition of architecture where technology and form meet. It's the tradition of the Gothic cathedral. And the guys who built the Gothic cathedrals were master builders. They didn't even call themselves architects. They were all about construction. And the same person that was designing the cathedral was also ordering how much stone we need and supervising the masons in erecting it and figuring out how we're going to get that scaffolding to work and the kinds of things we talked about in the construction of a Gothic cathedral. So it was a merger of technology and form. And really, the invention of the flying buttresses, those beautiful groin vaults, all of those are a marriage of physical considerations and form. Yes, they're astoundingly beautiful, but at the same time, they're absolutely generated by gravity and by materials and by understanding the technology that creates them. And I'm fascinated in particular in medieval times about this marriage between the two. So this is a little abbey. It's south of Paris, maybe 50 or 60 miles, the Abbey of Fontenay. And it's just a freaking ordinary medieval construction. This is not a great monument. It's not in the guidebooks. But it's, you know, an ancient building there. And so look in the slide on the left at just this masonry construction. This is not trying to be fancy. It's just this is the way it makes sense to make stone make these arches. And so it makes these beautiful arches, but that's just the sensible way in terms of physical considerations. Or these piers on that wall. And actually, the Rough Creek Lodge that we looked at last time that had similar kinds of piers, it's the same notion. It's the same physics that's generating it in both cases. But if you just have a stone wall like that, because the wind blows and, you know, the wall wants to kind of fall over like that, so you thicken it periodically to make it stronger. And that pier is there for a good structural reason. But I think that's really beautiful. I mean, I told you earlier, I'm a rhythm freak. I love just things that have these rhythms to them. And I love that facade for the fact that those piers give this regular rhythm. They're spaced regularly because that's how often you need a pier to hold the wall up. But the rhythm that that produces is actually very visually satisfying as well. And you can walk through this whole construction, and all it is a construction. Nobody was trying to be fancy. This really wasn't an architect doing it. It was a master builder. But you look at those beautiful groin arches, groin vaults. So they just wanted a lot of open space here. They didn't want any more wall than necessary because it's an industrial facility. They're trying to, you know, do their business. So they just have the few columns, and then they go up and they sprout into these beautiful groin vaults. And you can see all that construction here. And it's freaking beautiful. It's just, it's gorgeous. So technology and beauty married. Now, many great architects are like Calatrava in that they have that kind of marriage. So Le Corbusier, who we've looked at over and over, Rasmussen looked at him over and over. We'll look at him when you read The Place of Houses. It'll be in there too. You know, we think of Le Corbusier as this big artsy guy, and he was. He was a painter. He was a sculptor. You know, he was an artsy guy. But what's not talked about very much is the guy also was an engineer in some ways. He loved engineering. He wrote this book called Toward a New Architecture where he just, like, makes engineers glow in the dark. He loves them. He thinks they're so cool. Love engineering. He also, when he was about 30 years old, He invented a new system for casting concrete. That's what we call flat slabs now. But instead of having columns and beams, because you could use reinforcing in a certain way, instead of having all that complicated formwork to make all those beams, you could just vary the reinforcing in the slab, have simple formwork, and have it behave properly to hold the building up. That was his freaking idea, the whole idea of the flat slab. He called it Maison Domino, which that's a long explanation of why he called it that, but he called this little invention that name, and he patented it. And in periods when he wasn't getting much architectural work as a young architect, and he wasn't making much money at that, he was getting rich off his engineering patents. This guy had an engineering mind. Now, we think of him as making these sinuous walls at La Tourette. We'll look at La Tourette later, but those sexy shapes. But he's really thinking of concrete, this massive concrete. And when you warp it, it's like the piers give a resistance to lateral loads. By curving it like that, it gives a resistance to lateral loads. He likes expressing that rough, you know, crafted quality of concrete. And that's really what's making the architecture of La Tourette there. And then in a very different way, at about the same time, he's doing the Pavillon Heidi Weber, where he's using steel. And he's reveling in cantilevers and tension members and the thinness and lightness and those characteristics of steel. So even freaking Le Corbusier, who we think of as this artsy-fartsy guy, he's very much rooted in technology and engineering. Or Mies van der Rohe, again, we looked at him early in the semester. We looked at the Farnsworth house. And, you know, elegant, beautifully proportioned, pure, clean, less is more. I mean, we think of all those visual things about Mies van der Rohe. But what is the freaking Farnsworth house? It's a steel frame. It's an expression of that elegant, simple steel frame. So use my lawyer friend's comparison. What is the Farnsworth house about? It is about craft. It's about the way that building is made. In our mind, we can see it being assembled and disassembled. The columns, the beams, the passing connections, they're all so clearly articulated. It is a crafted building. And think of those three words, economy. Wow, there's not any fluff here. Nothing more than what's needed. Just the columns and the beams and the glass. It is its economy that gives its craft beauty. There's also complexity, raising it up off the ground, getting out of that floodplain. These platforms that take you up to this level of the house itself. There is complexity there as well. And then it is potent, this white stunning object in contrast to nature. The machine, the technological device that sits there in contrast to this beautiful, soft, natural site. So technology, beauty, maybe in fact these are connected. So let's go back to Santiago Calatrava. So he's in graduate school. He's 30 years old at ETH. He and a bunch of his friends in graduate school decide to make this temporary construction. And they're going to make a construction that is going to be stunningly beautiful, that's just going to make people, whoa, that is so cool. But at the same time, it's going to demonstrate cutting-edge technology. So they decide to build this construction in the library of the university. The library is an old 19th century building with a big dome, sort of like the Pantheon, big dome over a reading room down below. And so they decide we're going to build this construction right there in the middle of the library. And the construction held water. Now, you can imagine, in a library, you do not want water. You don't want all the books getting wet. It ruins them. They're going to make this construction with a ton of water, holding it up in this dome in the library. And they're going to do it with just a few little cables of steel. The amount of material for the whole thing would fit in a wheelbarrow. And we're gonna carry this ton of water in this very vulnerable place, and we're gonna use almost no material whatsoever to do it. So it's just made out of cables, and then the polyethylene plastic that's draped among the cables, and then they filled it up with all this water, and they made a swimming pool, and they put on their bathers and went up there, and they swam around in this thing in the middle of the library. Now, it was a cool-ass project. And it really, in some ways, tells you where Calatrava's head was for the rest of his career. It is about this craft, making something. It's about economy, just a few little cables and some plastic. It's about complexity, a very interesting shape that's made out of that, a shape that nature and physics gives you, but it's a beautiful shape. And it's also about potency. Holy moly, just kind of knocks you on your head. You walk in the library, shit, they're swimming in the middle of the library. It's powerful. So how do you use those principles to then make architecture? So Calatrava was interested in studying how nature did these things. Now, he thought that one of the most beautiful things in nature was a human body, in particular a kind of life, athletic human body. And he, like I said, he had all this background in painting, and so he does these beautiful watercolor sketches. And on the left, he's looking at the way our bodies move and the elegance and fluidity and beauty of our body. And then he's thinking of the technology of the body. How does that actually work? And how our bone structure is able to move in these different directions and create these abilities of our limbs and our torso to move in certain ways. And he's studying that. And then he uses some of those shapes and forms and analysis to make simple things, a coffee table, that's able to support itself delicately, fluidly, dynamically, not dumbly, but the way the body supports itself, which is hardly ever the static support. It's a much more dynamic support. And he looks at natural things. He looks at leaves. He looks at the body of fishes. And he looks at this notion of a spine and ribs. And that's in the human body, and it's in most animals' bodies. And that kind of infrastructure, a skeleton that gives form for very practical reasons. It is, again, extremely economical for our body to be supported by this bone that is our spinal column, and then to cantilever off of that bone our ribs and our arms and other parts of our body. So he studies that, and then again, he finds ways of how could I use those principles to make physical forms, like in this case, again, a coffee table. And then he begins to apply these things to architecture. So this is the first building he ever did. He's like, I guess he's 33 years old when he does his first building. He's never done anything before. And he's trained as an artist, he's trained as an architect, he's trained as an engineer. And at 33 years old, he does the Ernstein Warehouse. I mean, it's a dumb building. It's just a warehouse. Nothing glamorous about this commission. But it's very straightforward, and it's a limited budget. So he uses technology, engineering, physical considerations to see what kind of beautiful form he can make in a dumb warehouse. So for one thing, he looks at just the walls. A warehouse just has dumb walls, you know, no windows or anything. It's just for storing stuff. So he takes sheet metal, and he really tries to understand sheet metal. Okay, sheet metal is bendable, pliable. It's not very strong. You put a load on it, it just bends. But if you corrugate the metal, if you indent it, then when you put a crease in it, it gets stiff, and it resists loads in that direction. So he corrugates it at a micro level, and just every few inches he bends it and and makes a corrugation, and that stiffens it. And then he corrugates it at a macro level. So he takes all those people pieces and he bends it again, and that stiffens it again. So that the very least material, just like his freaking swimming pool in the library, the very least material, the least sheet metal, gets the maximum job done by corrugating it and making it certain shapes. And then in making it those shapes, he says, that's beautiful. Look at the rhythm of that. Look at the way it catches the light. Look at the kind of sinuous shapes that makes. That's what I want to freaking do with architecture. I want to understand how making craft technology can make beautiful forms. He does the same thing with just the doors. Very simple thing. I've got a bifold door. It's got a hinge in the middle, and it lifts. But instead of making that hinge horizontal, he makes a slight curve in the hinged pieces. And so when they open, they make these lyrical, interesting, sensuous shapes. But again, super economical. It's just the same simple bifold that any door for a warehouse like that might have had. But it makes something really elegant and beautiful. So Calatrava starts to design bridges. And maybe that's just the sweet spot between form and physical considerations, because bridges have a big job to do. It's like we saw the Pont du Gard, that great aqueduct that crosses the valley. It's a great bridge. And it made beautiful form by just using the technology the Romans had at their disposal. So now he's making bridges, and the first of these is in Barcelona. And it's an interesting program for a bridge. There's a big pedestrian crossing on both sides here. And that's because along the river there's a beautiful walkway and quay, and so people will walk up and walk across the bridge. And so they needed a nice, broad, pleasant place. And then when you get in the middle of the river, it bows out, so you can actually take a view down the river. It's quite a lovely view. So he's using those just programmatic elements to say, okay, these are two pathways, and then there's cars that have to go in the middle. And he celebrates the pedestrian pathway by making these supports that hold it up, and another support that holds the other one up. And then the roadway is held up by both of these arched forms. Now, the arched form we know is a good shape for structure. And then he's holding from those arched forms these cables that are in tension. And those are actually what's supporting the plane of the bridge itself. So it's, again, very simple structural economical way of creating the span, but at the same time, by the merger of the two arches, by the way the cables come down to support the pieces, it's making this lyrical and beautiful form. He does another bridge here in Sevilla in Spain. This was for, they had a big World Exposition in Spain, and this was the bridge that took you over to the exhibit grounds in 1992. But a very interesting bridge. And what's happening here is that's a big ass heavy piece of concrete back there. And it's at that angle, so it wants to fall down. It's trying to crash down there. It's being counterbalanced by these tiny, thin tension wires that are holding up the plane of the bridge. So while that's wanting to pull down, that's then making it support the bridge going out there. It's just counterbalancing. It's using the weight of one piece to support the bridge that's going across the river. Again, just very simple physics, beautifully engineered, well-crafted economy, complexity. This is not the way it's normally done. Yes, that's nuance. That's complex. And very powerful piece of sculpture in the landscape. A really famous bridge he did is actually just a little pedestrian bridge here that goes across the river in Bilbao in Spain. This is the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao by Frank Gehry, just down the river there. So you can see the Gehry building from the Calatrava Bridge, and you can see the Calatrava Bridge from the Gehry building. They're having a little dialogue with each other there. And this was a place where you walk down the river, and there was a kind of turnaround to walk back in the kind of central core of the city there. So there's this kind of complexity of turning around on the bridge. He's also using the complexity of cantilever, which is a very efficient way to support structures with that cantilever. He's mixing reinforced concrete with steel, each of them doing just the job they need to do. And then from that steel arched piece, he gets then the tension members, the suspension members that are holding the bridge up. The underside of the bridge with its structural ribs, you're seeing exactly the spine and the ribs that go from there. But the complex geometry of the curve and the river and the arch and the movement of people and the structural loads all create this dynamic, beautiful sculptural object. Is it powerful in form? Absolutely. It blows you away in terms of form. Is it completely engineering and physics? And of course, it's technologically driven as well. Is there a way, of course, to merge technology and form and physical considerations to make these sexy, wonderful, lean, economical, powerful kinds of forms? Now, Calatrava does bridges all over the place. He's done them all over the world. And in fact, we have one already here in Texas, and we have another one under construction here in Texas. So who knows about Calatrava bridges in Texas? Anybody know where that is? Okay, where is it? It's in Dallas. So one of those is that badass parabolic arch that then has all these complex tension cables that come off of it. And the other one is under construction. They're just putting up the major pieces of that. Both of them cross the Trinity River right near downtown Dallas. Now, he's also done other buildings. So this actually is a place where transportation mechanisms intersect. So it's a railroad goes through here, so it's a railway station. You transfer there to go to an airport, which is immediately adjacent. So it's really combining train transportation and air transportation, and the train transportation is one kind of technology and one kind of movement, and it's very earthen, it's very heavy, and then there's another kind of movement that's moving to the airplane, and it's very light, and it engages the sky. But both buildings, very much a product of thinking through the loads and the transfer and looking now at nature again, but maybe more spider webs and honeycombs that bees make. And you know, how are those these very elegant economical structures? And what could we learn from them in making things that are as beautiful as a spider's web or as beautiful as a honeycomb? But because they use these very simple natural principles. Calatrava went back to his hometown of Valencia, and he's done a whole slew of buildings there, and they're all in a little ensemble together, which is called the City of Arts and Sciences. So there's a big botanical garden that's got a big greenhouse in it. Some of these structures are reinforced concrete. That's like a big, strong bodybuilder. You know, he's got his trunk down here, got his muscular arms extended, and then holding up this lighter weight steel structure that you can see above it there. But there's something like our bodies, like things we relate to in nature that are beautiful, but at the same time, like in nature, are made in the most natural and sensible kind of way. So many different buildings in that City of Arts and Sciences. This is the planetarium there, where you have, you look at the stars and astronomy. Okay, it's all about science there. And then it has this big shell around it that makes the lobby around the planetarium. And that shell is made, again, of a bifold door that goes down and makes the perfect segment of a circle, or lifts up and allows people to go in and out and make it completely open air into that lobby of the City of Arts and Sciences. Maybe the most well-known building, certainly the most well-known building by Calatrava in the U.S., is the Art Museum in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This very interesting story behind this, because Milwaukee, Wisconsin is this Rust Belt city. It was an industrial city. And the people there, a lot of what they made were machines. So they had fantastic craftsmen in machine making. And so that's, and then, you know, a lot of that industry went abroad. And so in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, they were closing down all their factories and their machine shops and things like that. And these people were being put out of work. And they hired Santiago Calatrava in a way to come in and say, can you find some redeeming capability? Because we don't make machines here anymore. What could we do with our skills? And so he went in there and really made it a kind of Chamber of Commerce thing. We're going to use all of these skills of people who make things, physical objects, and we're going to use them to make this museum. So it actually is a museum that moves. It's a machine in many ways. So you come at it from the city in this direction. It's right at the intersection of downtown with Lake Michigan. It overlooks Lake Michigan, and it sits like a big bird looking out there at Lake Michigan, and like the prow of a ship kind of jutting into Lake Michigan. There's a bridge that takes you from downtown over a highway, because they were stupid and built their highway by the lake, because there was land, but it's not a very good use of the lakefront. So now there's a bridge over, and you can get to that land by the lake on the other side. And it's the bridge that connects it to the city. And then he, of course, makes one of these wonderful bridges where, again, like at the Alamillo Bridge in Sevilla, there's this rod that comes out, and then it has both tension cables in this direction and tension cables in that direction, and they're balancing each other to hold up that pedestrian bridge over the roadway. And then you go into this big bird-like volume there, with a great kind of grand entry. On the other side, it's adjacent to Lake Michigan. And again, it's sort of like the prow of a ship there. And in this part of it, it's really built into the earth. So a piece of this is like a bird that's flying, and a piece of this is very much buried in the earth. So those galleries here, and that which is a restaurant that spills out to the lakefront beside it, but made out of concrete, made out of earthen material, and then able to shape itself and cantilever like reinforced concrete can, but then return back to be a part of the ground. And in fact, that's where you enter the parking garage, which is in the belly of this beast on the lakefront there. So it's got this heavy kind of earthen, and there you get these arches and vaults and those technologies that have to do with earthen and masonry materials. And then on top of it, you get the bird. And this bird is very interesting because it flaps its wings. And in fact, those are sunshades. So you can either have the sunshade down and protect all the glass of this pavilion, or you can have the sunshade up and you can let all the light into that pavilion. And there's a sequence here I took where, you know, it's down and then it's up a little more, and then it's up a little more, and then finally it's up all the way. And it's really dramatic. I mean, people like stop and look at it when the building starts dancing there on the side of the lakefront. But it's also using that technology that was available in Milwaukee. These craftsmen that knew how to make machines, now a really, really badass, big, powerful machine that could actually make these pieces of the building operate. there you see a time lapse, that form of the building actually changing as the machinery drives it. And these pieces and parts that look, you know, you get the sense of movement and how the gears work and how they react to each other and how it moves. And then when you move inside, it's glorious. It is a beautiful, you know, awesome space. Beautiful shapes, beautiful light, beautiful sense of space. All of the whiteness, in a way, just taking out all of the any kind of static and just letting you see it just as pure form. And it's a very powerful sculptural form, even on the inside. And you're walking through that. And the dappled light, the light that changes as the sunscreen moves, the light that changes at different times of the day. And there are sunshades up here. You can see those vertical sunshades that actually control the light. So he's thinking of climate technology, not just structural technology, but climate technology as well. And this is everywhere in the building. When you get in that earthen part, again, now you feel more like caves and different kinds of shapes that make that. But everywhere, the form is both about being beautiful and it is very much about performance as well. That is the freaking parking garage. So you see the lines for the cars? Even the parking garage. How do we hold this thing up? Well, let's make a beautiful dynamic, and it's perfectly structurally rational how that parking garage is made, just not vertical and horizontal like we normally think of. Okay, same architect. I don't know if probably when you were about 10 years old, you might have seen the Olympics in Athens. He did all the big stadia and sunshades. This thing rippled and moved, so he's done other buildings that also have movement. There's a piece of sculpture in front of the SMU Art Museum, the Meadows Museum in Dallas. He did that piece of sculpture, which is one of those moving sinusoidal waves, but always inspired by construction and structures. And this building is currently under construction. It actually is almost finished. I was there not too long ago in New York City. This is right at Ground Zero on the old World Trade Center site. It's a new transit hub. Whoa, blow you away. Crazy, crazy looking subway stop there. Big, massive, but again, this merger of technology and beauty. Okay, that's the point for today. I told you your Twitter card question today is to, I'm gonna give you several options on Li Shihishong's book. So number one option is, I think this woman is dead on. Oh my God, this was a revelation to me. I'm going to change the way I'm living. Number one is, I like how this woman thinks. I think she's exactly right. We need to adopt her principles. The number two choice is, I get it. I think she's got some good points. I might do some of those things. I might turn my thermostat a little different in the summertime than in the wintertime. I might open my windows and get a little fresh air occasionally. I might do some of those things, but I don't buy into it the whole nine yards at all. That's the number two choice. The number three choice is, I get it. I understand it. I think she's a rational, sensible person, but I'm not really buying into it personally. I like my AC. I want it 72 degrees all year round. I, I'm